Have you ever been in a situation where you are so uncomfortable or you're so under pressure that you're tempted into telling a lie?
Not really.
Georgia hasn't, ever. Have you ever denied something that's true to avoid difficulty? Have you ever decided to be economical with the truth because it would be to your advantage? Our relationship to the truth is so easily affected by our desires and our circumstances. And our passage today that we're going to look at in our Who is Jesus series is from John chapters 18 to 19. And it's full of situations where people react to revelations of truth. They manipulate the truth. They avoid the truth. They misuse the truth to save themselves. And at the center of all this misuse of truth is Jesus, whose very presence confronts people with the truth, just because of who he is. And John's been making this point since the beginning of his book, because John presents Jesus not only as someone who speaks truthful things, but as the very truth of God made known in a living person. Jesus reveals the very heart and character of God and the nature of God's kingdom, not just in what he says, but in how he lives. Jesus is living truth, and to follow Jesus is to live in the world God created the way that God originally intended for us. To follow Jesus is to live in the truth. To deny Jesus is to exchange truth for a life built on falsehoods about God, the world, and ourselves. And the reason that we can look to Jesus as the one who is this lived out truth, the reason that he has the authority to claim that he's the truth of what it means to live in God's world, is, as John tells us at the beginning of the book, it's because Jesus is the one through whom the world came into existence in the first place. In John 1:1, we've read this at the beginning of this series. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and without him, not one thing came into being. What has come into being in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overtake it. And you'll see on the slide here, I've rather annoyingly put in this word logos after every time you see the word word. That's the Greek word that's used in John's original writing. In Greco-Roman thought, logos meant the underlying principle of logic and reason behind the whole cosmos, that if you could get in touch with this logos, it would bring true meaning to human life. And what John says here in John 1 is that the logos is not just a principle, the logos is a person, a divine person who has actually come into the world to reveal this truth to us. And John goes on to say that John the Baptist was sent to proclaim this logos coming. In verse 7, he says, he came as a witness to testify to the light. This is John the Baptist, a witness to testify to the light so that all might believe through him. That word witness is important. We'll come back to that later. John the Baptist himself was not the light, but he came to testify to the light. The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. So this logos, this person, was the light that brings understanding and truth to everyone. It's God's word through whom he commands, "Let there be light," who is now entering the world as the kind of light that is more than just photons by which we see things. But it's the light of truth which brings revelation and understanding about who God is and about who we are. And in verse 14, John says, "And the Word became flesh and lived among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory as of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth." This logos is God's Son. He was himself God, and he entered the very creation he made incarnate as a human being. And in his life lived among us, he revealed the truth of both God's grace and love and humanity's life and purpose. This is Jesus, the one who makes God truly known to us. But in today's passage, there are voices and forces in the world who cannot stand the revelation of truth in Jesus, who want to deny the truth of who he is, who have been conspiring against him. And then today's passage, the plans that they've made now reach their climax. And we want to ask, how will Jesus respond when he faces the forces of corrupt religion, political power, and even the betrayal of his closest friends? What will his reaction tell us about who he is? And so the scene opens with Jesus and his friends in a garden. And in John 18, verse 2, it says that Jesus often met there with his disciples. So this is a place that's well known. It's a place where Jesus hangs out with his friends on a regular basis. And whenever you hear any talk about gardens in the Bible, a little antenna should pop up in the back of your head. Gardens are really important because the story of God's relationship with humanity begins in a garden. And in that original story, God would meet in the garden with his friends until one day they weren't there. Their sin had caused them to hide from God as he moves through the garden asking where they are. In John 18, Jesus is in the garden with his friends, but he's not hiding. He's in a place where he knows he'll be found. And in this garden scene, it's the people full of sin and violence that come looking for the Son of God. And the question that's asked is not, where are you? But the question asked by Jesus in verse 4 is, whom are you looking for? They answered, Jesus of Nazareth. And Jesus replied, I am he. And when Jesus said to them, I am he, they stepped back and fell to the ground. Now, what is going on here? That's weird. Why would they fall down when Jesus says, I am he? John's gospel records several I am sayings of Jesus. You've got, I am the bread of life. We can put those up, Ash. We've got, I am the light of the world. I am the door. I am the good shepherd. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. And I am the vine. And these are all truth statements where Jesus reveals his identity as the one who leads people to God. But in this garden scene, his final and most simple I am statement, with that, Jesus reveals that he is God. I am he brings to mind another scene in another wilderness garden, the burning bush where God reveals himself to Moses as I am. And so when Jesus' captors fall down when he says, I am he, they're just demonstrating the same response that many people have had when they come into an encounter with the living God. And the group is comprised of Judas, one of Jesus' friends, the temple police, and Roman soldiers. They represent regular people, the religious authorities, and the political power and might of empire. And all of them fall down before the one standing in front of them, God in the flesh. And John wants us to see that Jesus has all the power in this situation. He's not captured against his will. He's not under threat. With his mere words, he can disable his captors with fear. In Matthew's account, Jesus actually scolds a disciple who unsheathes his sword to attack the police, telling him that he could call on 12 legions of angels if he wanted to. So Jesus doesn't hide. He doesn't lie. He doesn't try to weasel his way out of harm's way. In fact, John says in verse 4, Jesus knew all that was to happen to him. And yet when they come for him, he affirms exactly who he is, and he willingly surrenders himself to the mob. Before they take him, though, he takes care of his friends. He says in verse 8 to the mob that's come to get him, I told you that I am he, so if you are looking for me, let these people go. And with this, Jesus demonstrates in truth the very thing he told his disciples in the farewell discourse. And Sandra spoke about it last week in John chapter 15. He said, this is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. No one has greater love than this, to lay one's life down for one's friends. And so in this moment of extreme pressure, Jesus reveals this truth. He is the God who has come to lay down his life for his friends. And ever since his first friends went missing in that first garden, he has been looking for them. And now in this garden, he gives himself up to the evil of their sin so they can go free. And one more thing before we move on. I don't know if you notice this, but Jesus is arrested without being charged. The arrest is a fabrication. It's based on deception. Later on, they're going to make up charges, but Jesus isn't arrested for doing anything wrong. Jesus is arrested for who he is. It's his identity that matters in the whole scene. There's a wee funny thing in here, because I know this is quite heavy and there's a lot going on here, but there's a funny thing in this that I noticed. Seeing in all the other Gospels, when you have the thing about the disciple who takes his sword out, it's all, we don't know who it is. It's all anonymized. It's just the disciple. But John says, it was Peter. They've got this little rivalry going on. You know, John is, I'm the beloved disciple. We know Peter's important, but he's the guy pulling the swords out and being a bit of a rage, so. So the next part, Jesus is brought before Annas. Annas was a former high priest, and his son-in-law, Caiaphas, is the current high priest. And in fact, earlier in John's gospel, the chief priests and the Pharisees saw that loads of people were starting to believe in Jesus, and they were worried that this was going to cause trouble with the Roman government. So Caiaphas comes up with a plan in John 11. He says, it's better for you to have one man die for the people than to have the whole nation destroyed. And so from that day on, they planned to put Jesus to death. So although in this moment, Caiaphas is speaking from a kind of naked political ambition and deception, he didn't realize that he was also speaking prophetically, because Jesus' death was going to save the nation, and not only Israel, but all of God's children across the whole earth. And if we come back to John 18, we see that this plan is being put into action. The high priests who are responsible for sacrifices in the temple are now going to deliver Jesus, the true high priest, as a sacrifice for the people. And to help them do this, they're going to enlist the Roman governor Pilate with more deceit and manipulation. Pilate was the governor of Judea. By the way, I find out that they reckon, maybe, that Pilate was born in Scotland. I don't know why you're laughing and smiling about it. That's a terrible thing. We don't want him. We don't own him. Anyway, he may have been born in Scotland, but he's this governor of Judea, and honestly, that's a job that nobody wants. There were constant uprising in the area, and the job of the governor was to keep those suppressed, and Rome really liked control. Rome didn't like trouble. So probably Pilate is just trying to do what works to keep the peace and make sure that all the resources from the area keep moving back to Rome. And his initial response to the Jesus situation is just to dismiss it as it's just a peculiar Jewish problem. I don't want to get involved in that. And particularly, he doesn't want to get involved because there's no specific charges against Jesus. But the religious leaders draw Pilate into the situation. They start insinuating. They say, well, we wouldn't have brought him before you if he wasn't a criminal. And also, we want him to be put to death. So they're insinuating Jesus has done something so bad that it deserves the death penalty. But they say, because we're under Roman occupation, we don't have the power to do the death penalty anymore. The power of life and death is in the hands of Rome. And Pilate, you are the representative of the Roman government. And so Pilate, as a final arbiter of justice, calls Jesus into his quarters, and he asks him this in verse 33. Are you the king of the Jews? Okay, now where did that come from? Probably part of the insinuation from the religious leaders. This guy reckons he's a king, by the way. And you know what kings do. They rise up against other kings. Are you the king of the Jews? Jesus gets exactly what's going on. Do you ask this on your own? Or did others tell you about me? Is this your question? Or is this someone else's question? But Pilate is responsible to stop any kind of religious uprising. So that's why he's asking this. Because the result would be his life would be under threat if he allows it. And up until this point, Jesus has been really quick to quieten down any suggestion of being a king. Remember, if people would start talking about him being the Messiah, he'd say, shh, keep it quiet. Even his own disciples, he said, don't tell anybody about this after they confess that he's the Messiah. But in this moment, he allows his kingly identity to be fully revealed in front of the representative of the most powerful empire that the world had seen. But Jesus denies that he's leading a kind of rebellion, the kind of rebellion that may have been suggested by the religious leaders. In verse 36, he says, "My kingdom does not belong to this world. If my kingdom belonged to this world, my followers would be fighting to keep me from being handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not from here." So if this were an uprising, Jesus says, "Where are all my followers fighting to get me released?" This is a kind of kingdom which the world doesn't understand. It doesn't operate along the lines of power and violence like the kingdoms of this world. This king doesn't kill to stake his claim to rulership. He gives his life instead. And what Jesus is showing is true power, the power of love and sacrifice. And so, sensing that Jesus probably has no political ambitions, Pilate says, "So you are a king?" And Jesus answered, "You say that I'm a king. For this I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who belongs to the truth listens to my voice." And Pilate asked him, "What's truth?" Jesus says that his power and authority come from the fact that he speaks and demonstrates God's truth. The way Jesus rules is by the truth. And because of this, the power structures of the world, built as they are on deception and manipulation and violence, cannot understand Jesus. And as if to confirm this, Pilate responds with, "What's truth?" Because for Pilate, the only truth is the exercise of raw power. Whatever works to keep Rome on top, that's what's true. You may see that in the way governments in our world are run at the moment. For Pilate, truth is confirmed by whoever is victorious by the sword, or in this case, by the cross. And so Pilate has Jesus flogged and mock dressed in a robe and a crown of thorns. And Pilate hopes this is going to be enough to placate the baying mob that's now gathered outside. But they demand that Jesus be crucified, saying in verse 7, "We have a law, and according to that law, he ought to die because he has claimed to be the Son of God." This is their accusation, that Jesus has claimed to be the Son of God. But it's a false accusation, because Jesus hasn't claimed to be the Son of God. He's proven himself to be the Son of God by his truthful words and actions. And oddly, their accusation actually leads to a confirmation of his true identity. Next, they claim that if Pilate releases Jesus, then he himself will be guilty of rebellion against Caesar. So Pilate tries one more time to stop the madness, and he says in verse 15, "Shall I crucify your king?" And the chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." And then he handed them over to them to be crucified. So the religious leaders are now fully in bed with the Roman Empire. The people in the mob, the religious leaders, and the political powers have conspired together in such evil, deceit, and falsehood that they reject the very truth of God who stands before them. But this rejection gives Jesus the opportunity to demonstrate one truth, the truth that this is the God who will go through injustice, false accusation, torture, and the death of a criminal, who will allow the power of lies and deception to engulf him so that those who believe in him could experience true life. There's one moment when Pilate interrogates Jesus for more information in chapter 19, verse 10. He says, "Do you not know that I have the power to release you and power to crucify you?" And this is true. Pilate does technically have the power to spare Jesus or to send him to the cross. But in verse 11, Jesus answered him, "You would have no power over me unless it had been given you from above." Jesus refuses to concede to Pilate's power play, and he insists that the true power in the situation belongs to God. He is willingly laying down his life in line with God's salvation plan. And in doing so, he demonstrates the power of God to deliver his people. And he demonstrates that that power is greater than all other powers. Jesus could give in. He could play the game. He could bend the truth. He could tell Pilate what he wants to hear. And he could have his life spared. He could turn his back on what's true for his own advantage. But for our sakes, he remained a faithful witness to the truth. After all, how can the one who is truth deny himself? Now, the more attentive among you might have noticed there's one denial in this whole scene that I haven't spoken about yet. And it's Peter's denial of Jesus. Because first I wanted to demonstrate the way that Jesus remained faithful to the truth under immense pressure to bow to the demands of the religious leaders or the pressure of the Roman Empire. But in contrast, Peter can't even stand up to the pressure of a servant girl in the priest's courtyard. And the story of Peter's denial is well known. It's predicted by Jesus, and he's asked three times if he is Jesus' disciple. Three times Peter denies it. He denies his identity as Jesus' follower, and by doing so, he denies Jesus. And the reasons he's doing this are clear. He's in the high priest's courtyard. He's surrounded by temple police, even by a relative of the man whose ear he cut off earlier. Whoops. Imagine the fear when he saw that guy. There's danger in the air, and the pressure is on. And so Peter's asked to confirm the truth of his association with Jesus. And so when he denies that he's Jesus' disciple, he denies their whole history together. He denies the truth that Jesus has taught him and led him into. And he denies his confession that Jesus is the Messiah. In the moment of pressure, Peter abandons the truth and says that he has nothing to do with Jesus. And the likelihood is that each one of us has been in a similar situation, given the opportunity to speak about Jesus, to proclaim him as the way, the truth, and the life. We've probably instead abandoned the truth and denied him. We might not have done it to the full extent that Peter does here, but in a whole bunch of ways, when we feel pressure, or that our confession might damage our reputation, our status, or even our physical person, we keep quiet, or we water down our words, or we bend the truth of our dedication to God. But there's something else about this that I'd like us to see here, and it's where this takes place, because I think it's important. In verse 15 of chapter 18, it says, Simon Peter and another disciple, the other disciple is John, by the way. Simon Peter and another disciple followed Jesus. Since that disciple was known to the high priest, he went with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest, but Peter was standing outside at the gate. So the other disciple who was known to the high priest went out, spoke to the woman who guarded the gate, and brought Peter in. So this is John getting Peter into the courtyard. And the likelihood is that John's family supplied fish to the temple, to the priest's palace. And so he was well known for deliveries and that kind of thing. So John and Peter gain entrance, and they make their way through the complex to the courtyard where the temple police are stationed. And this is right outside of the high priest's chamber where Jesus is being interrogated. So you've got the chamber, and the chamber had an open doorway, a wall with an open doorway, and then you've got the courtyard directly outside. And what was going on in the chamber could likely be heard out in the courtyard, and what was going on in the courtyard could likely be heard in the chamber. And we know that also, if we turn over to Luke's gospel, let's show you what happens here. In Luke's gospel, chapter 22, verse 60, Peter gives his third and final denial, and it says this, at that moment, while he was still speaking, the cock crowed. The Lord turned and looked at Peter. So what does that mean? What does that tell us about the situation? Peter can see Jesus, and Jesus can see Peter. So John does this thing. He writes in an incredibly sophisticated way for the literature of the time. He keeps cutting back and forth between the two scenes, the scene in the chamber, the scene out in the courtyard, to build this dramatic tension. But there's one part in particular that's so astonishing, and you may not have noticed it before. I think it's astonishing. In verse 19 of chapter 18 of John, it says, then the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. Jesus answered, I've spoken openly to the world. I've always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews came together. I have said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who heard what I said to them. They know what I said. So when asked about the truth of who he is and what he has taught, Jesus says, don't ask me, ask my followers. Is it possible that even while he says this, he points to Peter standing outside? Maybe. Either way, Jesus can see them, and he knows that as he's speaking with confidence that his disciples are the ones who will testify to the truth of who he is, Peter is actively outside denying him. So what does this tell us? Is Jesus naive? Does he think better of his disciples than they really are? I don't think so. I think Jesus has decided to entrust his message to those who are weak and who are fumbling and who often deny him. He's under no illusions about who Peter is, and he's under no illusions about who you are. He looks at us with full knowledge of all the ways that you are capable of failing him. Today, you may feel weak. You may feel that your life is not much of a witness to Jesus. But Jesus says, I still choose you. I choose you as my friends, and I choose you as my witnesses. And of course, Peter would later have a moment of restoration with the risen Jesus over a breakfast of fish fillet sandwiches. And just as he has denied Jesus three times at a fire in the courtyard, he's restored by confessing his love for Jesus three times at a fire on a beach. But there's one more instant that shows us the power of that restoration. It's in Acts 4, verse 1. It says, while Peter and John were speaking to the people, the priests, the captain of the temple, and the Sadducees came to them. So now you've got the temple police, and you've got the religious leaders who are coming to Peter and John. They were much annoyed because Peter and John were teaching the people and proclaiming that in Jesus there is resurrection of the dead. So they arrested them and put them in custody until the next day, for it was already evening. But many of those who heard the word believed, and they numbered about 5,000, give or take. The next day, the rulers, elders, and scribes assembled in Jerusalem. With who? Annas, the high priest, and Caiaphas, and all who were of the high priestly family. These are the same people that have been questioning Jesus in the courtyard as part of his trial. And now they're questioning Peter and John. How will they respond in this moment of pressure? We know they've got form for denying Jesus. Verse 7. When they had made the prisoners stand in their midst, they inquired, by what power or by what name do you do this? And Peter then declares the power of Jesus as the one crucified and risen, and confesses in verse 12, there is salvation in no one else. There is no other name under heaven given among mortals by which we must be saved. So where before Peter denied Jesus, now empowered by the Spirit, he stands for the truth of Jesus as the only way that God has given to be saved. And the religious leaders are flummoxed. They don't know what to do, so they try to shut them down. In verse 18, they called them and ordered them, don't speak or teach at all the name of Jesus. But Peter and John answered them, whether it's right in God's sight to listen to you rather than to God, you guys be the judge of that. But we cannot keep from speaking about what we have seen or heard. Peter goes from the one who, under pressure, denies even knowing Jesus to one who can't shut up about him. So Jesus is not only a witness to the truth, but he is the truth himself. And in his trial, we see that truth on display. And this is the God who has come to exercise his power over the toxic and corrupt sinful rebellion against him that we've all engaged in by giving himself up for us, by submitting himself to the cruelty and the humiliation of false accusation, of violent mobs, of an unjust trial, and a criminal's death on the cross. His submission reveals the truth of the depravity of the people, the religious structures, the political powers, but also reveals the truth of the depth to which God will go to rescue us. And this is the truth. If you don't know Jesus today, you ought to know this. He's the one who gives everything for you to be free from the power of evil and darkness. even those powers which reside within you. And if you are a follower of Jesus, but you're aware of your own propensity to deny him, then you ought to know this. In your weakness, his love for you does not waver, and his commitment to you is steadfast. This is the commitment that took him to the cross, where all of your denial, all of their denial, all of the world's denial, from the powers, from his friends, was both revealed and forgiven. And it's Jesus' unwavering love for you that actually is both your judgment, it reveals your own weakness, and it's also your salvation. It welcomes you into relationship with him. Like Peter, you have the opportunity not only for restoration, but to become the witness to the truth that Jesus has always called you to be. Amen.